country has moved beyond violent crime and has become a hub for terror funding. We get the details from Willem Els of the Institute for Security Studies. Welcome, Willem.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you.
Can you give us a rundown of recent terror-related cases in South Africa?
Yeah. You know, the most recent ones that we have is the so-called Sharia Court case that is just before court in Johannesburg, where some of these radicals, they established their Sharia courts there, and they started to pester and victimize the Muslim community and others. Some of them have to pay the zakat to them, they're tithing to them. Some of them have penalties to pay to them. And they started to implement their Sharia law here in Johannesburg. And that is a group that actually stems from a previous group that has been arrested, also ISIS-related, in Slip River some 2-3 years ago, there where they found some paraphernalia of ISIS there, as well as they've been linked to the assassinations in Mayfair and extortions. So this group, you can see that they are not terrorizing the public. They are focusing on certain communities. They are using extortion. They are using crime in order to generate funding, and that funding, to channel that funding then towards ISIS. There's also another case currently before court in Durban, that is the so-called Del Vecchio case, where the British South African couple Saunders were murdered. They were abducted and murdered, and they really tortured them a lot. And then they extracted the information of their bank accounts and credit cards from them before they killed them. And what happened then, there was a person in Rotterdam that was arrested because he used the credentials of Ms. Saunders in order to purchase bitcoins, and he moved that bitcoins to ISIS for funding. And that person has been convicted. He's currently serving time. But here in South Africa, is still dragging on. So that is the Del Vecchio case, as we mentioned. It is the lady that was arrested there. She was also linked to the so-called Tulsi case, the Tulsi twin case that were prosecuted here in Gauteng. And the Del Vecchio guy, he's from a very affluent Italian family that owned these MSC cruisers and so on. So he's quite a rich guy. He was a convert, and then he was radicalized. Then also we had the Botch case, for instance. They call it the Huma case. That is when Farhat Huma and his cell was arrested in Cape Town after the extortion of Woolworths and the Spar. Also, there were two IEDs that were placed at the Durban July, and they threatened to blow to detonate those bombs if they not paid the ransom. And those people have been arrested. When they arrested Huma, for instance, they also found a drug dealer in his basement that was held for ransom there, and they were extorting from. So you can see that everything that they do is more or less focused on gathering funding and generate funding, and then to channel that towards the radicalized groups outside of South Africa. We see there's a route. They channel the route, the money from South Africa via various means, Puntland, that is the breakaway for semi-autonomous area in Somalia. And from there, they channel the money to either Syria, to ISIS, or to West Africa, or also to Central Africa, where they've got the Central African province for ISCAP in the DRC, but also to northern Mozambique. So South Africa became the hub for these type of operations from them for various reasons. We saw that about a year and a half ago, the Times had an investigative group that investigated terror funding in South Africa, and they come to the conclusion that in excess of 6 billion rand per annum is being sent to countries in question, and most of that money is believed to be allocated towards the funding of terrorism. Now, that is why one of the reasons why South Africa has been on the grey list, the FATF grey list, that is the international body sanctioned by the UN, that actually targets countries that are not bringing their side when it comes to money laundering and to countering money laundering, but also to counter-terrorist funding. And that is where we are at the moment.
Now, all this because the authorities let the situation get completely out of control.
Exactly. You know, it goes back a long way. If we see that after 1994, we went into a new dispensation. We had the Mandela era, and things were really going well for the country. I think everybody had high hopes that we are going to succeed. But unfortunately, you know, we came with a lot of baggage. One of the things is we had a counterterrorism act. Now, how can you have a counterterrorism act where your president was still on the terrorism list for the U.S., for instance? So then they decided to update or to rewrite the counterterrorism act, and for months they actually struggled to come across a name that is acceptable for everyone because of the sensitivities of terrorism and everything surrounding it. And they came up with what we refer to today as the POCTA-TARA Act. Now, even somewhere in that acronym, terrorism is hidden. But that is actually our counterterrorism law. It was a good law. It really strengthened the hands. And it was used in a few of the convictions. But when FATF approached South Africa, South Africa was supposed to do a self-evaluation to look at their weaknesses. They give you 40 points that you have to look at, and South Africa actually declined to do that. And then they had a mutual evaluation, and that mutual evaluation actually found us wanting in most of those areas. So South Africa also brought in the assistance of ISAMLIC. ISAMLIC is the Eastern Southern Africa body that works with FATF in order to strengthen but also to evaluate countries in this field. So that happened back then. And then, of course, South Africa received about 12 what they call immediate outcomes. Those are boxes that need to be ticked in order to be removed from the grey list. South Africa did a lot of work. One of them is that we had to strengthen our legislation. And we did so with the FIC Act, the Financial Intelligence Act. But also we had to amend the POCTA-TARA Act. And that amendment act was signed into law, and that strengthened the hands of the investigating officers, but also of the prosecution, in order to combat these type of crimes. So that is but those are only one of the boxes that need to be ticked. Another box that need to be ticked is we need to demonstrate the willingness of the willingness and the ability to effectively investigate these type of cases, but also to successfully prosecute them. And that is where we are still way off. Even though a lot of promises have been made, and it seems that FATF is happy with the status quo at the moment and the progress has been made, so chances are good that we might be removed from the grey list in October. But being said that is not where it stops. Now we have to present them with a maintenance plan. So how are we going to maintain our capacity, et cetera, et cetera? And that is where the challenge comes. They're busy with that. They're working on that. A lot of promises have been made. But of course, we have to honor those things. Now, otherwise, we might slip back onto the grey list.
Now, which organized crime cartels in South Africa do you think, or do you know, are strongly linked to terror funders?
You know, we identified about 12 main strands of organized crime syndicates that are operational in South Africa. But one that generates a lot of interest when you come to this is your illegal mining. Illegal mining is taking place. It's been something that has been way back in 1996. We already had our first operations in the Free State while I was still in the police countering this phenomenon. And we came up with recommendations, and it went to SADC. They actually drafted a protocol on mining where they set out steps and procedures on how to counter this. But unfortunately, we have not implemented that protocol, and now we are in trouble today with the illegal money. But, you know, gold is very much the same as money. It must be washed. Your origin must be cleared, et cetera, et cetera. So how do the Zamas now get rid of their gold, and how do we get that gold into the mainstream? So there's a lot of illegal activity because every organized crime syndicate has got other syndicates surrounding, and they layer out and enable us for them to be actually operational. So when it comes to, we picked up that there are certain groups that they go for gold, And what they then do is they register second-hand jewelry stores or pawn shops, and then they take this money, or this gold, and they melt it into a new bar, a gold bar, and then they certify it as to be recycled jewelry. And that gold is then exported to Dubai and to India as legal gold. So that's just one of the ways in which they are doing it.
So there's no way to estimate how much funding terror groups get from South Africa. If you look at all the different methods that money can be moved, including cash transfers.
Yeah, it's just tremendous, the amount of money. You know, it's actually obscene. If you look at the 6 billion that is just with your remittances, that is going from your spaza shops and your informal sector, that is going back to countries like Somalia and so on, that are actually countries in conflict where it is then assumed that it ends up in, much of it ends up in the hands of the terrorists. But also what we see is that it's not only gold, it's other commodities as well. You see that with human trafficking. You see that with every organized crime operation. And that is why the U.S. Treasury actually sanctioned one of the guys that's been arrested now with a Sharia court case, Gangat. He was actually sanctioned by the U.S. for being a trainer and being involved in organized crime to generate funds in South Africa. And that is why he was sanctioned by the U.S. just about a year ago. So the nexus between crime and terror funding is there. You know, organized crime can do without terrorism. They can live without terrorism. They can survive without terrorism. But terrorism cannot survive without organized crime and using that.
You would remember the case of Vicky Goswami. I just thought of him now, the drug lord, whose roots were being used to move money for terror groups. Do you remember?
I remember, you know, and that keeps on repeating itself. And, you know, we mentioned the triangle of your organized crime syndicates and the hierarchy and everything and how they need protection, et cetera, et cetera. Now in South Africa, the prevalence of your state-embedded actors on a very high political level and on operations level is way above the average for Africa. So that is very prevalent here in South Africa. And, you know, we are also part of what is referred to as the Southern Route. Now, what happens is with the heroin generated in Afghanistan, it is smuggled across Eastern Europe to Europe. They managed to curb a lot of those routes. They managed to put up a lot of hurdles for them. And so they resorted to an ancient trade route. It's called the Swahili Coast. Now, for 1,000 years, there's been informal commerce has been going on there from Yemen to Somalia to Kenya down to Tanzania and all the way down to Inhambane here in Mozambique. So all of those people, they speak the same language, they speak Swahili, they intermarry, their businesses are intertwined, and it's an ancient system that has been developed. And now the drug lords and also your organized crime syndicates, they infiltrated them and they utilize that trade route in order to move their commodities from drugs to human smuggling to firearms, they're coming to Mozambique. Some of them are also coming via Zanzibar on this route. So that is the problem. But now what happens is they enter with their products in northern Mozambique and southern Tanzania, and then comes across the borders to South Africa. And your problem is that tons and tons and tons are coming through. How many of those consignments have been intercepted in South Africa? That's a question. And it's not because they are so good, it's because they are well protected. A few months ago, there were two Tanzanians that were arrested in Limpopo. They were traveling with a vehicle with false compartments with an excess of, I think, 40 kilograms of heroin. And that's the first consignment that was stopped there that I can remember in the last 5 or 6 years. So that is a big challenge. Now your challenge starts not only in South Africa. We see that there are families in Mozambique that are actually dominating it, and those families are very high on the donor list for the ruling party there. The one person opened a hotel. He referred to it as a 7-star hotel. Even the taps are made of gold, and in Nampula, And he, the person who opened it, the hotel for him, was the former president of Mozambique, while he was a serving president. So that just demonstrates to us that the links between them. This guy has got two factories. He went into wholesale pharmaceuticals, and also in a soap factory. So in the port of Nacala, he's got these two factories. So all your precursors that are coming in is obviously dual purpose. And they also manufacture a lot of that. But that is not the end destination. The end destination in terms of our consumption is here. And then from here, it is distributed to other countries as well. So the southern route now is the heroin, for instance, that comes here. It is repacked. It's some of it which is used here. Some of it goes to Australia. Some of it goes to America. And a lot of it goes to Europe from here.
Mm. Now, meanwhile, there are several inquiries underway currently about the alleged infiltration of the South African police force by organized crime. So with the links between organized crime and terror funders, does that mean that the South African police force is also being captured in parts by terror funders?
There's a big possibility, yes. If you look at what happened, if you just look at the corruption, the sheer corruption in, for instance, the crime intelligence division. Back to the Munzuli days and after that the so-called cell phone grabbers that were purchased. It's coming back to the news. That might enter in also feature in the inquiry now because it dates back there. You know, and the impunity of these people that were pointed out and so on, and also your that's on the one side, and then your whistleblowers and the way they've been treated and so on. It's a murky world that we have. You know, the decline of the police service didn't start yesterday. It was systematic over many years, and it's rotten to the core when it comes to your senior management. That is your challenge. We do not know who to trust, and I think they do not know who to trust. There's a lot of divisions. There's a lot of political appointments. And also a lot of side interests. What we saw with that 29 year woman that was appointed as crime intelligence part of that case now. I mean, the section that she is heading is actually what we also refer to as your technical support unit of crime intelligence. Those are the technical guys. Those are the high tech that is being used there. And then they bring in a novice to lead them. So then you understand why we do not make progress. You know, some years ago in one of the provinces, it was still the crime intelligence of the technical support units within crime intelligence, and they advertised a new provincial post for a new provincial commander there, and there were quite a few very competent guys, and but the lady, the receptionist, also applied, and she got the post. And what happened then is within a month, better 3-4 months, everybody resigned. So they had to close down the unit. So that whole province was without that capability. And nothing happened about that. It's just, we just close that page, we move on. We managed to capture, we managed to sabotage the ability of crime intelligence to do what they need to do. And that is part of the state capture.
So if you look at the crime kingpins who are operating freely, while only the minions get arrested. Are we seeing the same situation here with the masterminds of terror funding? Some lower level people get arrested, but the masterminds are out there.
Of course, you know, and especially if you look at the Huma case, I think it was a very strong case. It was really, we got some of the high ranking people there. But unfortunately, like I said, the court threw it out. He scrapped it off the roll because of poor investigation, poor ethics, as on an investigation level, but also on a prosecution level. And was that deliberate? We don't know. We can only assume what happened there because it never came out. And there was never an investigation after that. They never came clear on that. And there we saw that the very same people that were actually released there, not long after that, there was a raid on one of their premises, and they were arrested with a lot of firearms, AK-47s, a lot of rounds, and so on. But mysteriously, the police failed to secure a search warrant, so they had to withdraw the case. Was that intentional, or was it incompetence? We don't know. But a lot of questions begs to be answered there.
So What do you think the real chances are of South Africa getting off a grey listing in October?
I think our chances are fair, but we're still in the crosshairs. We're not out of the woods yet. We see that countries like Mauritius, for instance, they came off the grey list in about 9 months, just over 9 months, a record time. They did pushed all the right buttons. But in the meantime, they started to decline and to fall back into the old habits again. So the chances are good that they will come under increased scrutiny, as they call it in that terms, where they might be referred back on the grey list. And you know, the next step when you're on the grey list, if you do not comply and you do not tick all the boxes, then you are moved to what they call referred to also as the blacklist, and then you're in trouble. You can't get decent monetary or loans from IMF or from anyone else. You know, money becomes very expensive. You can't move a lot of money. It restricts the economy of that country severely, and two of the countries, one is Iran and one is North Korea, that is on that grey list. And you know, we don't want to join them. So you mean on the blacklist?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're on the blacklist. So that is why it is important for us to be removed of the grey list. But also, there's another country in Southern Africa that's called the DRC, and they are in serious challenges because of the political challenges that they have, and also lack of will and other things. They haven't met one of their objectives of the goalpost so far. So that is why last week we were also in Darussalam to see how we can strengthen the hands of these countries, because at the end of the day, it's not the politicians that we are serving, that we are trying to help, is the people of the country that are suffering because of the grey listing and the economy that's not growing, etc. So that is why we have some international efforts. We partner with them in assisting them to for the technical ability and skills in order to tick a few of these boxes. And the same with Namibia. You know, just to demonstrate political will there, when they were placed on the grey list, their parliament, FATF gave in 24 months in order to clear themselves. And the parliament decided they will take 18 months. And they said, we will give you the resources, we will give you everything you need, you've got the political will, you get us off the list. And so we also work with their task team there, and they are making good progress. I think maybe by March, April next year, they will be off the grey list, just because of the demonstration of political will. Tanzania was on the grey list just over 12 months. So it can be done if you've got the political will.
Does South Africa have the political will? It seems to be brushing off punitive measures from the United States with quite a bit of arrogance.
I think that at the end of the day might prove to be our greatest downfall. As I mentioned, the self-evaluation report that could have been submitted by South Africa, we declined, and that was arrogant from us. I don't think we really understood the magnitude and what we are dealing with. And Namibia, for once, they did the annual their self-assessment, and they started on the front foot. You know, it's all about. Yeah, I think South Africa's got a problem where we maybe have a bit of too much arrogance when it comes to dealing with the international community, because we are not an island. You know, we're in the international community, and we have to play by the rules of the international community. And those rules have been there, they're embedded, they've been there for a long time. And if we don't understand and play according to the rule book there, you know, you might have some gains for a political party, but at the end of the day, your government, your economy in your country, the people are suffering. Of course, I mean, look at our growth, our economic growth, and everything else that has been stagnant for a long time. And these are some of the things that are causing that.
But if we don't have the political will even to bring crime against South Africa's own citizens under control, where would be the political will to try and bring international terror funding on its soil under control, Willem?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. You know, we will have to do a self-assessment and introspect and inspection as South Africa, because at the end of the day, you know, it's not conducive for us to be in this position. You know, terror funding has been with us for a long time. It's going to be with us for a long time, and the reason for that is that, you know, African countries, for instance, has got they're prone and they create conditions for these terrorists and the groups and terrorist funding to prevail. And we have to look at ways and means on how to put up hurdles for them and not to be effective in South Africa. We know that South Africa has got a wonderful financial system. Our economy is still very strong, strongest in Africa, etc. So that those are all the conditions that are there to facilitate, of course, the ease in which this money can be moved, etc. But also, if you look at the root causes for terrorism all around the world, you've got certain root causes that stand out, and one of them is marginalization, where people feel so marginalized that they don't participate or they do not have the opportunity to participate in the political field or to counter it. For instance, in some countries where they still vote along tribal lines and clan lines, we got minority tribes that they will never be heard because of the majorities are there, and that is something that needs to be done. And that's what's happened. You know, when Mandela, for instance, took over our first government of national unity, we started to bring everybody together. Everybody felt that they were part of the future. The moment the people are excluded, it generates these conditions for them to thrive. Poor governance. If you look at your poor governance, the failure to deliver the political goods. If you look at northern Mozambique, why is Cabo Delgado being targeted? First of all, they got the commodities there, they got the resources, but also they have a tremendous or a lack of governance, not even poor governance there. And those create your conditions for these organized crime syndicates and your terror groups to move in and to exploit the situation.
Now, Willem, you spoke about that workshop you facilitated, hosted by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. What was the most important, what came out of that?
Okay, what came out of it? That we're all under pressure because of our challenges. Africa is being targeted because of our lapse, or poor governance, or limited governance, limited resources, but also a limited use of technology in order to counter it. And that was one of the big things. Where you look at South Africa now, we've got the Financial Intelligence Center that has been empowered by the new legislation. You need to export the new latest technology as well. And it costs money to do so. So it's a lack of funding that is there. But also, if you look at the strategy of the now the former minister, or still the minister of police, where he one of his goals was to embrace technology in the fight of crime, and that was one of the big takeaways and how to use technology in order to counter crime. But also your public sector, private sector partnerships, because a lot of this technology and the skills are not embedded in your civil service, in your police services, and so on, and how they can take hands. One of the things that was very prominent is what they also refer to as OSINT, that's your open source intelligence. We've got a very limited capacity within your law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies to exploit that and to utilize that. Lisa, they mentioned that more than 90% of all your new intelligence projects originate with OSINT. So that is the way of the future. You have to explore that. You have to utilize that because the criminals are using it. They're also always one or two steps ahead of us, and we're not going to catch up and overtake if we do not focus on that. Those were basically your takeaways there. Also, your importance of capacitating your specialized units and your specialized investigation intelligence units and financial investigations. You know, policemen, the moment there are numbers involved and algebra, then they start to shy away traditionally, and that the capacity is not there in most of these countries to do thorough financial investigations, and that is also a field that's been identified. We're looking at how to capacitate them, how to do that programs to strengthen the hands of the law enforcement agencies in Africa in order to do so.
Thank you. That was Willem Els of the Institute for Security Studies speaking to BizNews about terror funding in South Africa and on the continent. Thank you, Willem. I'm Christine.